lecture in a Formation Continue series for this year. I think we've had a wonderful year filled with topics as varied as health law, the environment, criminal law, and procedure. Et pour terminer notre année, nous allons revenir à une tradition que nous avons commencée dès le début, de terminer sur des sujets de la common law. Ce soir, les sujets particuliers seront remedies et restitution, des termes qui n'ont pas de traduction précise en français ou en droit civil, même si, comme nos conférenciers vont nous parler, le droit civil a certainement des équivalents. I hope that you have all enjoyed the 15 hours of continuing legal education that we've offered this year. We've certainly pulled out all the stops for you to offer the best we can, top-notch professors and speakers, interesting topics, and a well-organized lecture series. As you know, we offer these series practically for free. Okay, it costs $20 a lecture, which, as you can imagine, does not cover our costs, however minimal they are. We have no administrative or secretarial help, but we do provide live feeding of the lectures into the rooms across the hall so that more lawyers and notaries can benefit from our educational outreach program. And we do hire a student to help with the organization. And perhaps this is an opportune moment to recognize the hard work and wonderful results of Benjamin Flight. Benjamin, where are you? If you could stand up. Benjamin has been our student coordinator for the last 2 years. As my co-organizer, Véronique Bélanger, said, we have tried to delay your graduation so that you could continue doing this, but we just couldn't do that. But really, he's the one to thank for all the perks you get, including your attestations emailed to you practically the next day. So on behalf of all of us, thank you, Benjamin. But my colleague Véronique Bélanger and I co-organize these series and work on a pro bono basis, as do all the lecturers and volunteers. Believe me, it's very hard to stand up here and ask for money, but I am asking you all to consider giving something back to the faculty as recognition for what we have done by way of this educational outreach and in order to help us maintain our excellence in these programs and in all our other endeavors. No amount is too little, or too much, of course. So please take the time to fill out the pledge card that you have been handed upon registration this evening. And on behalf of the faculty and in advance, I thank you for your help and your generosity. Before we begin the formal part of our program, let me make a few housekeeping announcements. Of course, shut off anything that buzzes or rings or makes noise of any kind. We are going to, as usual, have one break this evening, and it will be after our first speaker. During the breaks, you may, of course, use the washrooms, which are located downstairs, get some water from our water fountain and some snacks from the table manned by the students in the atrium. As usual, the food is not for sale. Rather, the students would appreciate any donation for what you take. This time, all proceeds will go to support the Human Rights Working Group, which is a diverse collective of student advocates whose purpose is to promote human rights education at the faculty and on the McGill campus, to raise awareness of and reduce human rights violations within the wider community, and to assist law students in finding employment opportunities in the field of human rights and social justice. As we began to do this year, you will receive this magic email almost the next day from Benjamin with your attestation certificates. For that, of course, you have had to register at the desk. If you haven't done so, don't worry. You can do so during the break, but please ensure that you will do so or we won't send you the certificate. The PowerPoints from tonight's presentation are already posted on our website because we had wonderful speakers who handed them in to me early enough to do that. All past PowerPoints are also posted on the Formation Continue website. I do have to apologize that the speakers who used Prezi, those presentations are not posted because we can't post Prezi presentations. But to the extent that speakers all year have used PowerPoint presentations, they are up, including tonight's. And finally, we really encourage you to ask a question so we can have a lively Q&A. You were given a piece of paper. You may write your questions on the piece of paper, particularly if you're in a breakout room. Students will come by to collect them. Or, as we've begun to do this year, you can simply raise your hand and I'll repeat the question for the benefit of those in the other room. All right. Turning now to one of my favorite parts of our program, I'm really delighted to present tonight's présidente d'honneur, Ruth Sefton Green. Professor Sefton Green, as you will soon hear from her accent, is British by birth and education, having received her BA and MA from the University of Oxford. After qualifying as a solicitor in England, she went to France to obtain her DEA en droit privé, as well as her doctorat en droit from l'Université Paris 1, becoming an avocat au barreau de Paris along the way. As befits her dual citizenship and her dual legal training, Professor Sefton Green has made her mark on legal academia in the realm of comparative private law. Having taught at both l'Université Paris II and Sciences Po, she has been a professor at l'Université Paris I, Panthéon-Sorbonne, since 1999. She is equally at home teaching the history of English legal thought and the French law of contracts. Des fois, elle enseigne en anglais, d'autres fois, en français. A prolific writer, en français et en anglais, on topics ranging from the harmonization of European law to contract law and remedies and social justice, she has published a book entitled La notion d'obligation fondamentale, comparaison franco-anglaise. It is therefore no wonder that she has felt so at home here at McGill this semester, where she is visiting as a Wainwright Senior Fellow. And equally, no doubt, why we here at McGill have become so taken with her. But it is not only her academic qualifications that have endeared her to us. It is her wonderful personality, warmth, and ability to have become part of our McGill community even during such a short visit. Ruth, you are definitely a soulmate. Who better then to speak to us briefly about tonight's topic, the law of remedies and restitution in the common law, and why Quebec civil law lawyers need to be thinking about this stuff. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Ruth Sefton Green.
Merci beaucoup, Rosalie. Je suis ravie d'être là. Je trouve qu'il est extrêmement important pour les juristes du droit civil d'apprendre quelque chose sur la common law, même si, pour vous, il s'agit plutôt de prendre votre téléphone pour appeler un collègue à Ontario. Et je trouve qu'il est absolument formidable que cette formation continue à McGill comprend cette possibilité pour vous de faire un peu de common law ce soir. Alors, moi, je souhaiterais de tout mon cœur qu'on fasse pareil dans les pays de l'Europe, dans l'Union européenne, très franchement. Je suis très inspirée d'être ici à Montréal et à McGill. Et une des choses que j'aime beaucoup, c'est le fait que je ne me sens plus du tout à l'envers. So, to continue, one of the things that has been a great pleasure for me here at McGill is to feel at home and not on my head upside down and back to front, as I do in Paris, for the reasons, as Rosalie pointed out, that I teach common law to French students in English and in French, and I teach French law to students in English and in French. And here, all of this is just something that everyone does all the time. So, where could I be if it's in a better place here? For that reason, I've now lost my thread. I don't know why I've lost my thread. Yes, I know what I wanted to say. It's that it seems to me that I have had a very inspirational time here at McGill because I've realized quite how much there is this fabulous mixture in the Quebec Civil Code. And that's an inspiration both for my thinking about French law and also about English law. And one of my colleagues said the other day that when he first came to Quebec, he understood that all Quebecers slept with the civil code by their bedside. Now, I have a big problem because I'm going to have to sleep with two civil codes by my bedside. So luckily, I'm not an insomniac. And on that note, I think it is time to share my enjoyment of being here with you and to pass la parole as Professor Stephen Smith. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ruth. I was there when our colleague said that we all sleep with the civil code next to our bed, and my response was, my students don't even sleep with the civil code next to our bed. So, as I get this PowerPoint up, it now gives me a lot of pleasure to introduce you to my colleague, Professor Stephen Smith, who will speak to you about the common law of remedies. Professor Smith obtained his BA in political science from Queen's University and went on to pursue his undergraduate law studies at the University of Toronto. He then completed a doctorate in law at Oxford University, which he obtained in 1992. After clerking for the then Chief Justice of the Supreme Court of Canada, the Honorable Brian Dixon, and teaching at St. Anne's College, Oxford University for several years, we were extremely lucky to lure him to McGill, where he has been teaching and pursuing research since 1998. His chief areas of interest are private law, particularly contracts and remedies, and legal theory, particularly private law theory. And he has turned those interests not only into an illustrious teaching career, but a very prolific research career as well. In addition to countless articles, Professor Smith has published an extremely well-received book entitled Contract Theory, and he has authored the sixth edition of ATIA's Introduction to the Law of Contracts. His legal scholarship has been recognized in part through his receipt of the prestigious Killam Research Fellowship for his current research on remedies, which I'm sure he'll manage to work into his presentation somehow. In addition to having an outstanding legal mind and being a creative and careful scholar, Steve is a wonderful colleague. Being fellow travelers on the contract road, I am so grateful to have someone like Steve to contact moments before my contracts class to ask in a panic, what did Lord Hoffman do in the Achilles case? And he will always tell me, and somehow those classes turn out to be my best. By the way, he does the same to me, except his queries are usually, Rosalie, does Article 1404 of the Civil Code say what I think it says? Or, just this morning, what does Article 1693 really mean? Ladies and gentlemen, you are in for a treat. Please welcome Professor Steve Smith.
Thank you very much, Rosalie. Well, I think that the first thing I should do is to explain what I mean by the word remedy, because I can't even tell you what my talk's about unless we know what that word means, or at least what it means for me. And it's a difficult word to translate into civil law terminology, and indeed, for reasons I'll explain in a moment, it's arguable that the concept doesn't even exist in the civil law. But it certainly exists in the common law, although even here, it's used in many different ways. But probably the core meaning of remedy, and in any event, the meaning that I'm going to be using today, sees a remedy simply as an order or a judgment of a court. So a remedy is what plaintiffs go to court to get. They want to get an order or a judgment that requires the defendant to do something. So a common example is an order for a defendant to pay a debt, to pay damages, to deliver contractually promised goods, to stop using copyright material, to cease trespassing on the plaintiff's land, and so on. So the subject of my presentation, the law of remedies, is therefore the law that governs the availability of court orders of the kind that I've just described. Now, the first thing that I want to say about this law, sorry, there's my definition. I'll keep up with that now. The first thing that I want to say about this law is that in the common law, it's regarded as a distinctive, large, and significant legal subject. There are regular conferences on remedies. There are lots of books on remedies. Common law faculties invariably offer courses called remedies. I teach one myself. And as you probably know, the civil law looks very different. Civil law courts do, of course, grant or issue what common law lawyers call remedies. Civil law courts order defendants to pay damages, to deliver goods, and so on. But the idea that the law governing the availability of such orders could be a distinct and important legal subject seems very odd to most civilians. And I think it seems odd because in the traditional civilian way of understanding law, the law of remedies is almost an empty subject. In the traditional civilian understanding, there's no law here because remedies are just the flip side of rights. Or maybe there's just one rule, and the rule is that courts should tell people, defendants, to do what they already had legal duties to do. So once you've figured out the party's substantive rights and duties, what they were supposed to do before they came into court, the court's job is just to rubber stamp those rights and duties. The court, it just orders the parties to do what, as a matter of the substantive law, they should have done already. So there's not really much going on. Now, most common law lawyers would accept that many court orders are just rubber stamps, just like this. So, for example, I think most common law lawyers would accept that when a court orders a contracting party to pay a debt or to deliver contractually promised goods, that the court is just ordering the defendant to do what the substantive law already required the defendant to do. But in other cases, common law lawyers would say that the rubber stamp model is inaccurate. And an obvious example, maybe not the most important, but I think an easy one, is an order to pay punitive damages. So common law lawyers would say, and I think correctly, that when a court is ordering a defendant to pay punitive damages, they're not telling the defendant to do something the defendant should have done already. Insofar as there is a duty here, it's created by the court order. The court is creating that duty to pay punitive damages. Another example is an order to pay damages in a case where the defendant has failed to perform a contractual duty. For example, failed to deliver goods. In a typical case in the common law, the order will be an order to pay damages, not an order to actually deliver the goods, which presumably is the substantive duty. Now the question, in my view, it's really the most fundamental question in the whole law of remedies, is how many court orders are like those examples I just gave. Many civilians, and actually many common law lawyers also, would argue that the cases in which courts do something other than just rubber stamp existing rights and duties are fairly rare. And they might also order that when courts do this, they're usually doing it for merely practical or procedural reasons. So in the civil law, the rules governing specific performance, when a court will order you to perform a contract, are often considered just parts of the law of civil procedure, and they're not really substantive law. I'm not going to try to settle this debate here, but I'll just make two observations. The first is that many common law lawyers take this idea that there's a real law here quite seriously. And as an example, many common law lawyers, and I count myself as one of them, suppose that not just punitive damages, but every kind of damage order creates a new duty. Right? That there is no duty to pay damages until the court makes the order. There's various reasons for this, but historically it's quite clear, in fact still as a matter of positive law in the common law, that there is legally no duty to pay damages until the court orders you to. So imagine that I accidentally break your window and I send you $100 to fix the window and you're still angry at me or whatever, and so you sue me. And I get into court and the court determines that it's $100 to fix the window. And I say, well, I already paid $100. As a matter, the law is absolutely clear. You still win. Right? You will still get a judgment that I have to pay you $100. Now that $100 that I paid you earlier, I might be able to use it to get it back in unjust enrichment or something. You won't end up with $200. But formally, you will win. And the explanation goes all the way back to the 13th century, where the courts made clear that you could not avoid going to court in a case where someone was suing you for a wrong, for damages, by paying damages. You had to go to court and you had to have the judgment made against you. And criminal law and tort law were actually closely combined, so they thought of them kind of the same. And that is still the case today in the common law. Right? This is clearly very different from the way that the civil law thinks about things, right? The civil code, our civil code, is absolutely clear that anyone who has caused harm through their fault has a duty to make reparation, to pay damages, right? So we see this in 1458? 1457, sorry. It's also in 1458 of the civil code, right? And that duty to repair the prejudice is considered in traditional Roman law, goes all the way back to the Romans, just another kind of duty, like the duty to perform a contract, the duty not to trespass, the duty to pay damages, right? As an aside, there's something interesting that I noticed when I started thinking about this question. As you go into the English translation of this, this really isn't anything about my talk, but I bring it up because it's kind of interesting. You go to the English translation of that section, they mistranslated it. At least if they meant what they should have meant. Rather than saying that if you cause damage, through if you cause a harm, loss through your fault, that you have a duty to repair the injury, which is certainly the traditional civil law view and what it says in French, what it says is you're liable to reparation. Now, liable is a tricky word, but what it is understood really to mean in English, to say you're liable to repair, liable means something is liable to be done to you. So we say, you know, if you commit a crime, you're liable to be punished or liable to be fined. You're liable to have a court do something to you. That language, I think it must have been infected by thinking in common law terms, because common law lawyers say you are liable to pay damages, which means a court might force you to do it, not that you have a duty to do it. And actually, they use the language there. I think it's just a mistake. And they use it quite often in the civil code. And I'm not the only one who thinks that's a mistake, but I think it is a mistake, and it's a common law way of thinking about damages. All right. I said I'd make two observations. The second observation is that these different ways of thinking about the law of remedies can, I think, be traced back to very fundamental different ways of thinking about law and the way that law evolved in the common and civil law. Now, both of our previous speakers have made a joke about the colleague who talked about the civil code beside the bed. Well, that was me, because when I came here, I can't remember who the dean was. I think it might have been Justice Casera, and he was probably joking, but I didn't realize it at the time. He said, Steve, you know, every Quebecer has a civil code beside their bed. It's the code for life. It's the way you're supposed to lead your life. Now, I realize that isn't entirely true, but there is a truth to that, which is that the civil code was developed, I mean, the civil law was developed primarily by philosophers, theologians, people who were trying to develop a code for life. I mean, Napoleon was very clear about this, which is one reason the French code is written so nicely. He wanted it so that every Frenchman could understand it, because it was meant to be a code for how they should lead their lives. It didn't have very much to do at all with litigation, right? And Napoleon didn't want judges to have anything. They couldn't even interpret the code, right? So it was all about how people were supposed to lead their lives. In other words, about the duties that we have. They didn't think much at all about what judges were supposed to do. They were just, you know, the functionaries who did what Napoleon had told them to do, right? Civil common law, entirely different, right? In the law developed out of litigation, right? And the early common law rules were really rules about when you could get into court and what sorts of remedies you could get. And they were really rules for judges, right? They were telling judges what they should do when these people came before them. I mean, people just started coming to judges, the judges started giving decisions, and they started to build up a body of rules, which were rules that they shared amongst themselves about when they should give this sort of relief or that sort of relief. And so it's very natural for common law lawyers to think of remedies not just as part of the law, but actually as the core of the law. And many historians say that until a few centuries ago, really all the law in the common law was remedies. It was all about what a court would give you, what kind of relief a court would give you. So it's very natural for common law lawyers to think that a lot of law is really law directed at judges telling them what to do. Now, my own view is that both views are exaggerations. There's lots of substantive law out there that's telling people how they should behave, but there's a significant amount of law which is really law directed at judges, and much of that, I think, is the law of remedies. Okay, so that's it for the academic part of my presentation. I'll turn now to the law. And as I said, the law of remedies is a large topic in the common law. So to make it more manageable, I'm going to focus on private law remedies, and further, I'm going to focus on remedies for breach of contract. Two reasons. One, for practicing lawyers in Quebec, I think contract remedies are probably a little more relevant than tort remedies. Lots of clients have contracts that go outside of Quebec, but if you have a tort that's committed outside of Quebec, it's going to be dealt with typically by a lawyer outside of Quebec. Second, the differences between civil and common law remedies are more significant and a bit more interesting, I think, in the field of contractual obligations than in extra-contractual obligations. I will just say a couple of things about extra-contractual obligations. The first is that for contract lawyers, extra-contractual remedies are very important. In just about any contract, any but most simple contract claim, there's usually a potential for an extra-contractual claim. And in the common law, this is different from the civil law because there is no rule of non-commule in the common law. So it is very often possible to bring essentially the same grievance, either as a grievance in tort, in delict, or in contract. So if the contract contains a false statement of fact, what common law lawyers call a misrepresentation, you can often sue in contract for breach of contract, but also in tort for a misrepresentation. And sometimes there's very slight differences that might give you an advantage in one or the other. Right? Another reason that extra-contractual obligations are important for contract lawyers in the common law is the growth of fiduciary obligations. Fiduciary obligations are obligations where one party has a duty to act basically in the utmost good faith towards another, in the best interest of another person. So lawyers, as you know, have fiduciary obligations towards their clients. And this idea of fiduciary obligations has been a growth industry in common law Canada. Common law Canada is kind of the world leader in finding fiduciary obligations. It's kind of joked that everyone in Canada, outside of Quebec, owes fiduciary obligations to everyone else. That's not quite true, but our courts do like to find them. And the reason that's significant for remedies is that the remedies for breaches of fiduciary obligations are particularly generous and particularly strong. So sometimes you might have a contractual claim, but if you can also show that the breaching party owed a fiduciary duty, you could make a claim on the basis of breach of fiduciary duty and get even better remedies. Okay, so let me turn finally to examine the kinds of court orders that might be made in response to a breach of contract. And I thought it might be useful to help to structure the discussion by imagining the options that a plaintiff might have in a hypothetical case. I'm not going to discuss all the options in equal detail, but I think it's kind of useful to have a sort of big picture before your mind. And the case that I'm going to imagine is a contract for the lease of equipment, in this case, a crane. Okay? And I'm going to suppose that the lessee, the plaintiff, the person who's leasing the crane, has paid the price, they've paid the rental price, but that the crane that the lessor, the defendant, delivers doesn't meet the contractual specifications. It's a defective crane. And the question is, what are the lessee's options if he ends up going to court? Now, it's probably unnecessary to say this, but my discussion is in one respect unrealistic, in that I'm going to assume at every point the parties aren't going to negotiate. What they want to know is what happens if they go to court. Okay. Now, the lessee's options depend in the very first instance on the seriousness of the breach. Right. I'm going to run this up to the end. You'll see. All right. That is, it depends on whether this is classified as a serious breach, which common lawyers often call a breach of a condition, or a minor breach. Right? And if it's a minor breach, not a serious breach, then the lessee's only recourse is to accept the crane, and to sue for damages. Right? I just note here in the civil law that there is another alternative in this case, which is the remedy of a proportionate reduction in your own obligation. Right? 1604 allows for entitled to a proportional reduction in your obligation if there has been a minor breach. Right? This wouldn't be particularly useful in this example because the person has already paid the price. But the point I want to make, this doesn't exist in the common law. I mean, you could try to write it into your contract, but there is no right to this. And the fact that it doesn't exist in the common law is part of a general pattern that we'll see, or a general difference between the common and civil law, which is that the civil law often tries to come up with remedies that will help the parties to continue in their contractual relationship. So we'll let you continue, but you just have to pay a little bit less, right? The common law is not particularly interested in forcing the parties to stay together, or even in making it easier for them to stay together. It has a kind of clean break principle, and we'll see that in some other areas. Okay, so let's suppose that it is a major breach, right? Not a minor breach, right? The common law confusingly calls this a repudiatory breach sometimes. Again, then the lessee has a number of decisions to make. So we've got a major breach. First decision, the lessee can, of course, just accept the crane. Okay, it's defective, but I'm going to take it anyway, and I'll just sue you for damages, right? And that's possible, of course, right? It might seem odd that you would accept performance despite a major breach, but in the common law, as in the civil law, it's often the case that certain kinds of breaches are deemed by the law to be major, even if their consequences in the particular case aren't that serious. Right? So the Common Law Sale of Goods Act provides that any breach of a duty to provide merchantable goods, no matter how trivial, allows the innocent party to reject the goods. So you have the right, this trivial breach is considered by legislation serious, you can reject the goods, but of course you don't have to. There's another reason, and this is a more important one for thinking of differences between the common and civil law, which is that in the common law, the parties can stipulate in their contracts that a particular breach is a major breach, regardless of how serious that breach actually is. So you can put a clause in your contract and all sorts of commercial contracts. In fact, most loan agreements in the common law that I've seen will have a clause which will say all and any breach of any of the conditions or clauses in this contract is considered to go to the root of the contract and gives us the right to terminate the contract, which is to say it has the effect of making this a serious breach, right? And as you probably know, that is different from the civil law, right? The civil law has the same general rule. Minor breach, you can't terminate. Major breach, you can. But in the civil law, this is actually one of the most significant differences in theory. I don't know if that works out in practice, but in theory between civil and common law of contracts, so that in the civil law, this is a matter of public order. You cannot contract around it. Right? And I always point this one out. I sometimes teach courses to common law and civil law lawyers, commercial lawyers. And this one, I'll just tell you, the common law lawyers cannot believe this one. Right? They say, every second contract that I write would be inconsistent with this. This is freedom of contract. If I want to say I can terminate after this trivial breach, why can't we agree to that? Right? And it's a very, in theory, I say in theory because I keep trying to push, and maybe someone can tell me after how it actually works in practice, because I find it hard to believe that Quebec judges apply this literally, because in the common law, it would mean that so many contractual terms would be invalid. It's absolutely standard that they stipulate that any breach gives us the right to terminate. But you can't, in theory anyway, do that in the civil law. Okay? That's part of the idea of keeping the parties together. Let's suppose, however, that the lessee rejects the crane. This is a serious breach. They want to reject the crane on the ground that it's serious. In this case, the lessee, again, has some more decisions to make. And the first decision is, do you want to end the contract or at least try to put an end to it, what common law lawyers usually describe as terminating the contract and what civilians call resolution or resiliation. That's your first choice. Now, in Quebec, the lessee probably wouldn't be able to immediately do this, or at least not do it immediately, because under Quebec law, as you probably know, a breaching party has the right, in some cases anyway, to cure the breach within a reasonable time. Now, it's a very horribly complicated area of the law. I try not to have to teach it. I don't teach to my first-year students. Very complicated regarding notices and whether the parties can exclude the right by contract, but the basic rule is there's a right to cure, assuming that curing is still possible and feasible. The traditional common law, in its typical way, its typical nasty way, you might say, has no right to cure. Right, so here again, we see the clean break principle in action. Assuming that the breach is classified as serious, the lessee can just end the contract immediately. And he does this very simply. He doesn't have to go to court, doesn't have to give formal notices, just say, I don't want the crane, go away. And that would be the end of it. Okay? If the contract is terminated in this way, then again, the lessee has a decision. And again, the lessee can ask for damages. So terminates the contract and ask for damages. But an alternative, and I stress that this is an alternative because you can't combine it with damages, the lessee can just ask to get his money back. I don't think there's any, this is also possible, of course, in the civil law. So the lessee can ask for what is typically called restitution, and we might hear a little bit, I'm not sure, I don't know if you'll be talking about this issue a tiny bit in the second half of the talk, okay? This is fairly straightforward, getting your money back. The situation I'll just mention is more complex, as in the civil law, where the benefit that the plaintiff has conferred under the contract isn't money, but some sort of partial performance. Right? So if I've done some services for you, then you commit a serious breach and I want to terminate the contract. Can I get back the value of the services? And the short answer is yes, you can get back the value of the services. But there's problems when it's only partial performance, and the law is a little bit complicated here. Right? But let's turn now to the second option, where instead of ending the contract and asking for either damages or restitution, the lessee wants to keep the contract alive. He says, okay, this is defective. I don't want this crane, but I want a crane. Please get me a proper crane, right? Now, in this case, if the lessor does perform, so the lessor delivers a satisfactory crane, then the lessee's only recourse, as in the previous case, will be a claim for damages. So if the lessor performs, again, you ask for damages. But what if the lessor doesn't perform up there, right? You keep waiting, they don't perform. Now the lessee can go to court and has another option of asking for an order commanding the lessor to perform. In other words, you can order what common law lawyers, or ask for what common law lawyers call specific performance. Right? Right. Where am I? Did I get that one right? Sorry? Yeah. I'm losing it myself now. Hang on. There we are. My number is like. I've got it right, but my number... Oh, no, I've got it right. Sorry. Okay, I'm sorry. I don't usually do these complicated ones with my students, so anyway. This took me a long time to make. I'm very proud of it.
Okay, so the lessor can ask for specific performance. So the question I want to consider now is, would the lessee be granted specific performance? The short answer is, in the common law, quite clearly no. Probably no in the civil law. Now, as I'm sure you know, the common law and civil law are traditionally said to have very different approaches to specific performance, to orders that force the party to do the very thing they had promised to do under the contract, right? So in the common law, specific performance is said to be a secondary remedy, something that's granted only when damages are inadequate. In the civil law, by contrast, specific performance is said to be the primary remedy, right? This conventional description is nice, this distinction or difference is nicely illustrated by a pair of cases that we always teach to our students, each involving anchor tenants in shopping centers. We have lots of cases on anchor tenants in shopping centers. In both cases, we had supermarkets who had broken their leases, and the leases required that they stay open and keep working. And the Quebec case is La Cité Concordia, and the UK case is Argyle Shopping Centers. And what's interesting is that the courts reached opposite results, right? So in Quebec, the court ordered the defendant shopping center to stay, defendant retailer to stay open, right? And in the UK, although it went all the way to the House of Lords, in the end, they refused that. They said, no, it's too difficult to supervise, too uncertain what performance actually requires. You know, do they have to have 5 people at the desk, or how much goods do they have to have, blah, blah, blah. And so they refused. Okay?
notwithstanding those famous cases which seem to show this difference, in my view, the differences between the two systems are often exaggerated as regards specific performance. A couple of points here. So the most common court order, what is the most common remedy? It's one that, strangely, we never teach our students because there isn't a lot of law on it, but the most common remedy is an order to pay a debt. Somebody didn't pay a contractual debt, and you go to court, and the court will order them to pay the debt. Right? Now, common law lawyers don't call that specific performance for historical reasons having to do with the courts of equity of law that I won't get into, but any civilian looking at it would say, well, that looks like specific performance. It looks like ordering the person to do the very thing they were supposed to do under the contract, and indeed it is. It's just not called specific performance, but it is the single most common remedy that you'll find in common law courts. Secondly, if you have a contractual obligation to not do something, so to refrain from competing or to not use certain products or something like that, the common law courts will routinely order specific performance of those duties. Same with injunctions, right? And this is moving outside of contract and a tort, but if it is a duty not to trespass, not to cause a nuisance, the courts will enforce those with injunctions. They will order the parties not to do those very things, right? In the civil law, of course, specific performance can be refused in cases that, quote, do not admit of it, which in practice ends up pretty close to the same cases in the common law. In both the civil and the common law, leaving aside the debt cases, where you tend to get specific performance is in cases for land and cases for unique goods. The final point is that in Quebec, the law on interlocutory injunctions, which in practice turns out to be more important than the law on regular injunctions or specific performance, seems to be governed by common law rules as well. So that makes another reason there's not as big a difference between Quebec law and common law on this topic. Right? Final thing to keep in mind is that when we're thinking about this difference between the common and civil law and specific performance, is that when in the civil law damages are awarded for breach of contract and that they are measured as they usually will be, at least at a minimum, at the cost of getting substitute performance from somebody else. So in the case of non-delivery of goods, I will get damages that allow me to go and buy the goods from somebody else. Those damages are often described in the civil law, indeed in the code itself, as performance by equivalence. So civil law lawyers often think of what common law lawyers call damages as a kind of specific performance. So when you take all those differences put them together, the differences are not, in my view, as big as many people think, right? But there is one other feature of the law regarding specific performance, which is, I think, interesting from a comparative perspective. And it's a feature that also applies to injunctions. Injunctions being, they're just negative orders. So orders not to trespass, orders not to cause a nuisance, that sort of thing, right? And this feature is that courts may refuse such awards on the basis that the person asking for the award was, broadly speaking, acting unreasonably or had delayed unduly, or simply that the award would cause undue hardship. So I'll give you an example. In the common law, the standard rule in a case of a contract for the sale of land is that you do get specific performance because land is considered unique. Canadian law is changing a little bit on this, but that's still the traditional general rule. Every piece of land is different. Damages are therefore inadequate. Therefore, if the vendor doesn't sell you the land, you can get specific performance. But in a famous English case, Patel versus Alley, the courts refused to give specific performance on the ground that even though all those arguments were met, it would cause undue hardship. So the case involved a Mrs. Patel whose husband had sold their property, and then, now I've got to go all the facts right, a series of terrible things happened. He died. One of her kids became very sick. She became sick. She had no money, and she was still living in the house, and she was supposed to give it up to this new purchaser. and the purchaser sued for specific performance. And what she argued was that now that her husband had died, they had no money, she was relying on the kindness of all the neighbors around her to help her get by with her children, and she or her child was an invalid. So she needed this community of people around her. She didn't have anywhere else to go. I mean, if her husband was still alive, she would have. And so in the circumstances, ordering specific performance, the court said, would cause a great hardship in this particular case. So we're not going to order specific performance. She still had to pay damages, but she didn't have to get out of the house, right? And that sort of argument, I mean, it doesn't come up very often, but it can definitely be made when you're asking for a specific performance or an injunction. Now, why in this case it has, why can you ask for it here, but not, why these arguments can be made here, but not for other remedies, has to do with historical distinctions between the courts of law and equity, which I won't get into. But what's interesting from a comparative law perspective is that for civilian, this looks a lot like good faith. It looks a lot like roughly saying we're not going to give specific performance if to do so would, if the purchaser is acting in bad faith or if this is an abuse of right or something close to that. And here it's quite explicit that the common law does this. And interestingly, Rosalie and I've talked about this. It's not clear that in the civil law you could make the same argument. I mean, it'd be hard to argue against an order of specific performance in the civil law on the ground of hardship. The common law, which is usually considered and is indeed pretty nasty, harsh, rigid, etc. But in this case, it's more flexible, I think, than the civil law. It introduces these good faith concepts at the area when it's thinking about specific performance. Now, I said that I thought specific performance probably wouldn't be awarded in my example, but if it was, then, as in the civil law, the court can, of course, award damages in addition, right? Damages, you get specific performance and damages to compensate for the late performance, as you would know. But let's assume that the court refuses to order specific performance, and in that case, lessee's only remedy is, damages. Right? One point to add here, a point which has attracted some attention in the common law, is that assessing specific performance, assessing damages in a case where specific performance is refused can be complicated if the market has been rising or falling. Right? The difficulty is that not entirely clear at what point damages should be assessed. So suppose, it's a little unrealistic, but suppose in my example, crane is defective. The lessee says, go away, bring me back a proper crane. And the lessor goes away and delays, nothing happens. Finally, 5 months later, the lessee gives up and says, okay, I'm going to court. Goes to court, asks for specific performance. The court says, no, we're not going to give you specific performance, as they almost certainly wouldn't. Damages are inadequate. We can give you money. You can just go out and get another crane from somebody else. We'll just give you the money. But at what point should the cost of getting a crane be assessed? I mean, it's the market price, but is it at the date of judgment? Or is it at the date when they originally refused to show up? I mean, you would think it should be the date of judgment, because until then, you're sitting there waiting for the crane. And that is indeed the general rule. But the common law has made clear in a series of complicated cases that in some situations, it will not use the date of judgment rule. In some cases, it will say, no, you should have gone out and tried to get another crane earlier. It should have been clear to you that you were not going to get specific performance, because the rule is pretty clear. You don't get specific performance. The other party didn't tell you they were going to perform, so you should have gone out and mitigated to try to get your crane from somebody else earlier. So let's suppose that between the original date and later, the market price of cranes went up. They say, well, you should have got your crane 6 months ago, and that's the date that we are going to assess the damages by. So as you can imagine, it's complicated, and it puts the innocent party in a difficult position. Should they wait? Should they go out and get another one? It's a hard decision. But what's interesting is that the common law does not assume that you can just sit there and wait for performance. Right? I find it very difficult to work out exactly what the civil law position is on this. I mean, in theory, the civil law takes the idea that you should perform more seriously, so you would think you should be able to sit there and wait in the civil law. But the civil law also says that damages, you can't get damages for losses that you could have reasonably avoided. So the civil law, you know, it could say the other thing. One thing I know for sure is that when you look it up in the books, And you look up in textbooks what to do. In common law textbooks, there's tons on this. There's lots of cases, lots of discussion. I can't find anything in civil law textbooks, right? There's a lot of law on all these questions in the common law. There's much less law in the civil law. It's just hard to find out what the answer is, right? I mean, this particular question, every contract lawyer, I don't know how many of you do contracts, but every contract lawyer in the UK would be aware of this question. We'd be thinking about, oh yeah, I know those cases. Yeah, there's lots, you know. They would have opinions and all that, right? I find it much harder when I'm looking at textbooks and I'm trying to find the answers in Quebec, because remedies are not a big topic. People don't talk about them as much. Although perhaps practicing lawyers have a good idea of what's going on. But in the textbooks written by people like me, these things aren't talked about too much in the civil law. Okay, so I'm going to turn now to damages. And because if you look at these slides here, you've seen that almost every point along the way there is a possibility of getting damages, right? The actual damages that you'll get will differ a little bit depending, of course, on what stage you're at in the process, but the general principles are the same, and that's what I want to try to talk about. I'm not going to go into great detail, but try to give you a little bit of an overview of damages and show you some of the principles. As ever, there are options, but you'll be glad to see I don't have as many boxes as before, so it's a little bit simpler, okay? So I'm going to begin by discussing what are the sort of standard, ordinary, normal damages, what are usually called compensatory damages. Later, I'll say something about nominal damages, punitive damages, and restitutionary damages. First, a general comment. There is something I just said a moment ago, but I'll repeat it. There is a lot of law in the common law on damages. Right? There are entire books, really fat books, on damages. There are entire books on particular kinds of damages in the common law. And this reflects, again, the fact that the common law arose from litigation. In litigation, damages matter a lot. Most contract claims, you know they broke the contract, and you know they're liable. The question is, how much money are you going to get? And, of course, do they have that money? You know, do they have the assets? So for litigants, damages are a really important issue, right? In French law, traditionally, they're considered much less important. In France, damages are a question of fact. Right? They are for the trial judge. So you get almost no academic discussion or no discussion in the higher courts about the measure of damages. Whereas in traditional common law, damages is a huge topic, and it's studied extensively in first-year contracts courses and is the subject of many, many of the leading cases in the highest courts are on damages. Now, the general rule in the common law, as in the civil law, about compensatory damages is usually said to be that damages should put the plaintiff in the position that he or she would have been in if the contract had been performed. And that's, I think, broadly correct. But it's important to see that this idea of putting you in the position you would have been in if the contract had performed is pursued in has two different elements to it, or two different ways of pursuing, which I'm going to describe as damages for the cost of performance and damages for cost for consequential loss. Okay. So one thing, let me start with cost of performance. One thing that's going on within most ordinary damage awards is the award of a sum that represents the cost of obtaining substitute performance. Right? So how much would it cost you to go out and purchase the performance that you were promised from somebody else? So in the lease example, how much would it cost you to lease this crane from someone else, right? Of course, if it's too late or if the plaintiff no longer wants performance, the courts won't bother to give this. But if it's possible and desired, then it is normally awarded, right? As I said, in the civil law, these are often thought of as a kind of substitute-specific performance, as performance by equivalence. Some common law scholars think of these awards in this way, but many of them don't. And they will often point out that, amongst other things, that courts will refuse such awards for reasons that they would not deny a contract. So, although you can typically get the cost of performance, the courts will refuse it if they think that the cost, the value of that performance is out of all proportion to its cost. So the famous and leading case involves a swimming pool. A builder is hired to build a swimming pool. This is a case in the UK, Ruxley Electronics. And the swimming pool is a few inches not deep enough. It's not quite clear. The court disagrees with how shallow it is, but something like 5 or 9 inches, not as deep as it is supposed to be. And the owner, who's upset, sues. And they're not going to get specific performance in the common law, but normally you would think you could get damages, and you get damages for the cost of cure, for the cost of digging up the pool so that it's the proper depth. The problem, of course, is that to get that extra 5 inches, you basically have to rebuild the whole pool. So the cost of cure was basically the same as the original cost of the contract, something like £22,000. And the court accepted evidence that this difference in depth had no effect at all on the use of the pool. That it was you could dive in it, you could do anything. Nobody needed these extra 5 inches. They said, we'll give you a couple £1,000 for, you know, I don't know, your inconvenience and upset. But we are not going to give you £21,000 to redig this pool because it's basically a waste and we don't think that you really need it or want it, right? We think you're just doing this, I don't know, out of vengeance or something like that. So they refused it. Right? And there are lots of cases where they have done this. Right? Now, I recently learned that Quebec is the world leader in outdoor pools. I don't know if you knew that. I think we have more outdoor pools per capita than anywhere. And if you're in a plane, you look down, you can see this. They're not usually in-ground pools, but there's lots of them out there. So you would think we would have a case in Quebec on the swimming pools, but apparently we don't. But Professor Septon Green diligently has found an almost identical case in France with same thing, it was a few inches depth difference, and the French courts, without any thinking, hesitation, or even the slightest concern, ordered the cost of cure, ordered that they had to pay the full cost to get the whole pool replanted, whole pool rebuilt. And the common law did not and typically would not do that. Okay? If you think, as the French do, of specific performance as a primary remedy, as cost of cure, as a kind of substitute for it, then the French position makes sense. Okay. Now, the other thing that's going on in most ordinary damages awards is an award of a sum of money measured by the extent of losses that the plaintiff suffered as a consequence of the breach. Right. So consequential losses include things like lost profits, out-of-pocket expenses, from a delay or from a defect in performance. Now, as in the civil law, the plaintiff always has a right to make a claim for such losses. And the general principles are the same as in the civil law. So in both systems, the general principle is that you can recover for damages or losses that are reasonably foreseeable. And there's not a great deal you can say about what makes something reasonably foreseeable, except perhaps to say that it is clear now in the common law, maybe more in the UK than in Canada, but I think it's coming to Canada in the same way, that the test for reasonable foreseeability is not a test of probability. And in particular, that one thing the courts need to look at when they're determining what sort of losses that are a consequence of the breach, what sort can you recover for? How far down the line can you go? That you need to look at the underlying purpose or nature of the contract. So let me give you an example from a famous UK case. The case happened in the 1960s, a shipping case called the Heron 2, and it involved a contract for the shipment of sugar from Constanza to Basra. The owner of the sugar had wanted the sugar shipped, and he wanted to sell the sugar when it arrived at Basra, and he did indeed sell the sugar when it arrived at Basra. However, the ship was 9 days late. Right? And during the 9 days, the price of sugar dropped. So when the owner of the sugar sold the sugar after 9 days, he obviously made a lot less money than he would have made if the ship had come 9 days earlier. The owner won. So the owner sued for the difference in price, for his loss of profits, and the owner won. And if you interpret the idea of reasonable foreseeability literally, this makes perfect sense, because it's perfectly foreseeable that the price of sugar might drop, and the court held that there was a 50-50 chance the price could go up or the price could go down. But in a recent case called, another shipping case called the Achilles, which I won't go into the facts of, but which I will tell you the reasoning of, the court made it pretty clear that if this Heron case came again, the court would have reached the opposite result. the owner would lose. And the explanation would be that this kind of contract is not intended to shield the owner from changes in market prices. This is sometimes explained by saying that if the parties themselves had put a clause into their contract to say what should happen if the price of sugar goes down or goes up, the clause would not have made the shipper responsible for the loss of profits. The chance of it going up was or down is 50-50, right? Making the shipper responsible for the price going down effectively makes the shipper the insurer of the market price. Well, shippers aren't in the business of insuring market prices. They don't know anything about that. But owners are. I mean, they know that the prices can go up and down. They have to hedge. They have to do all sorts of things to prepare to look after the possibility of prices going up and down. So I said, between these two parties, they would have put the risk of the price going up or down on the owner because that's the owner's business, right? And so the courts now say that in a case like that, we will not make the shipper liable. And they explain this by saying that the purpose of this contract is not to put the risk on the shipper. It's not to make the shipper is not meant to be the insurer of the contract, right? And this has nothing to do with foreseeability in the literal sense, because it's perfectly foreseeable that the price will go down. It's just not the kind of risk that is meant to be allocated, the courts say, to the shipper, right? As an aside, the UK courts and Canadian courts are moving in the same direction, are taking the same approach to tort cases. Right? Again, they ask about the underlying purpose of the tort duty. So the leading cases, there's a whole bunch of them, all arose from a crash in the housing market that happened in the UK in the 1980s. So what happened was just before the crash, banks had made all sorts of mortgages. And in the UK, they make those mortgages after they've got a valuation of the property from an independent valuer, from a professional valuer. What happened was that those valuations were, in many cases, inaccurate. To make things worse, then the housing market dropped. Right after they made the mortgages, the housing market dropped, and many of the homeowners couldn't pay. So, of course, the banks want to sue somebody. The homeowners don't have any money, so they go after the valuers. And they argue, it wasn't that the valuers should have known that there was going to be a housing crash, but even independent of that, they had made they'd overvalued the properties, even independent of whether there was going to be a crash. And they said, well, if you hadn't made these high valuations, we wouldn't have entered into these mortgages, or we would have done on different terms or something, and therefore we wouldn't have suffered from the housing crash, right? And the properties that we have as security became worthless. And the court rejected this argument, right? They said, well, look, maybe you wouldn't have entered these mortgages. You would have made other mortgages, right? The valuers are responsible for the difference between the price of the house as it actually was at the time of the valuation and the value they made. So if they are responsible for the extent of their mistake, but not for the subsequent crash. Right? That's not their business to insure against that sort of crash. So again, the result is that a loss that is perfectly foreseeable, it's perfectly foreseeable that the market might go down, is held to be too remote, and the defendant is not liable for it. Okay. The final final point about ordinary damages, well, it's really about the second type of damages I want to talk about, is that despite the range of different grounds on which such a claim might be founded, there's no guarantee, of course, that a victim of breach would get anything by way of damages. So in my lease example, if the lessee just turned around and leased from somebody else for the same price a day later and the delay didn't hurt them, they haven't suffered any loss at all. Okay. But in the common law, and this is a difference from the civil law, it's not a particularly important practical difference, but there is a difference. And in the common law, even if you cannot prove any loss at all, you will still get an award of damages. You'll get what is called nominal damages, right? So in a case, it could be a contract case, it could be a trespass case, you've trespassed over my land, I sue you for damages, there's no loss at all. The court will still order nominal damages. It's a symbolic kind of award. It might be a dollar, it might be $10. Breach of contract, I don't suffer any loss at all, still I will get nominal damages. And this again shows how the common law thinks about damages. This isn't like we suppose you had a duty to pay this amount. We're using it as a kind of like a punishment, like a fine. It's a symbolic thing. Your right was infringed.
you deserve, we have to make this clear. The only way we do this is by forcing this defendant to pay some damages. Just a nominal amount, but it's symbolic, right? It's not about moral duties. It's about making a statement. Okay. So,
I hope you're all taking notes, right? Because there's a test at the end, right? You gotta.
Okay, all right. So I want to close by briefly considering two further kinds of damage awards that plaintiffs might be able to obtain. Okay, the first is punitive damages. Now, the common law has long been more receptive to the idea of punitive damages than the civil law, but even in the common law, punitive damages are traditionally only available for a small range of tort cases. In Canada today, however, punitive damages in common law Canada are very widely available. They're available in principle for any kind of tort, and even more significantly, and here again, Canada, common law Canada, is a world leader, punitive damages are available for breach of contract cases. The leading case, as you probably know, involved an insurance company that refused to pay, in bad faith, refused to pay out under a policy. In that case, the Supreme Court suggested that punitive damages, although we're allowing them here, are going to be rare, not very common in contract cases. But people who've looked, I have some friends who've looked through the lower court decisions in Canada, and it appears that common law courts are giving punitive damages in contract cases quite frequently. Many of them are in consumer cases, where in principle they're allowed in Quebec, but not all. In theory, they're allowed in commercial cases, and that is happening also. It's a little hard to say what the test is in contract. I mean, you have to have a breach of contract. You have to have behavior that is high-handed, oppressive, or malicious. That's for any type of punitive damages, tort or contract. You have to have that. They say in contract you also have to have an independent, actionable wrong. And nobody really knows what this means. But the Supreme Court has held also that even in the common law, contracts have to be performed in good faith, which means there's a duty of good faith. So if you act oppressively or maliciously, you're not acting in good faith. So pretty much it's always easy to satisfy this test. That's why the lower courts have been able to award punitive damages quite frequently in contract cases. And this is a real development because it never happened before. And even now, it doesn't happen in other common law jurisdictions, except, of course, the United States. They like to do this. All right. Okay, finally, a couple of words about restitutionary damages, so-called restitutionary. You'll hear a bit more about this in a moment. I say so-called restitutionary because we tend to think of restitution as giving back somebody something, whereas in contract, what we're really talking about is forcing you to give up something, all right? To give up some of the gains that you might have made from a breach. Right? Now, as with punitive damages, the traditional approach of the common law is, like the civil law, that restitutionary damages are not available for a breach of contract. But as with punitive damages, there has again been a big change of attitude in the common law. In part, this is because the common law lawyers have looked back at some old cases and said, I think those really are cases not of compensation, but of restitution, of we sometimes say disgorgement, of forcing you to disgorge, the profits you make. So there are two groups of cases here. One group of cases is sometimes described as cases in which the defendant did the very thing he had contracted not to do. So many of the cases are like this. A city council sells a plot of land, and they sell it to a developer, and they sell it subject to a covenant that you can only build 40 houses on this plot of land. The developer takes the land, builds 60 houses, right? City all of a sudden realizes, oh my God, city goes in. If they're quick enough, they could get an injunction to stop it. But once the houses are built, common law courts are not keen on ordering houses to be knocked down. Too much waste. So they say, we're not going to order them to be knocked down. City says, okay, we want some damages. The court says, well, what is your loss? Well, the city hasn't lost anything, right? I mean, they didn't suffer, they got more taxes, you know. So they can't show loss in any ordinary way. But it seems wrong. I mean, this guy blatantly broke the contract. Can't you get something? Well, in cases like this, the courts have said, yes, you can. And they have given the city councils or equivalent plaintiffs a share of the profits that developers made in such a case. The other sort of case where something related has happened are often called cases of skimped performance.
But my favorite example is an American case from the turn of the century, City of New Orleans versus Firemen's Association. So the City of New Orleans wanted some firefighting services. So they contracted with this company to provide for them for 2 years firefighting services. And the contract said you have to have this many men, this many horses, this many feet of pipe, etc., always ready, willing, able to fight fires during the whole 2 years. Well, what happened was during that 2 years, they didn't know it, but they learned later, the company only had half the men and half the horses and half the hose that they were supposed to. But there were barely any fires, right? So the ones they had were enough to fight all the fires. So the city sued, but they didn't have any losses, right? Now, in that case, using traditional common law reasoning, the court said, you get nothing. You haven't lost anything, right? But now there are cases that are going the other way. People say that's wrong. There's a lot of arguments that that's wrong. And there's a movement towards giving damages in such a case. Finally, I'll say that this movement has received a huge boost from a famous recent UK case, which Metra Rabinovich will say a little bit about, called Blake versus the Attorney General. This involved George Blake. You might have heard of him. He worked for MI5, but he was also a spy for the Russians. And he was caught, but he managed to escape from Wormwood Scrubs, the prison, and he went to Russia, lived a happy life there. Still is. I think he's still alive. Not sure. But he wrote a book. That's the book. And this book was making lots of money, and it was published in the UK. And the government wasn't very happy. This book was all about his life as a double agent. Right? And so they weren't very happy, so they sued him. And his contract had a clause which said he was not allowed to divulge any of the information which he divulged in this book. Now, it was too late. They weren't trying to stop the book's publication because actually the information was all public knowledge. They just didn't like, they wanted to get back at him, so they wanted the profits that he made from this book. And they got it. And it's a landmark case. So the first case where the contract case, we have stripped the contract breacher of their profits. Now, obviously, it's an unusual case, has, you know, government involved, public security, all sorts of things. But it has been followed in other cases. Not clearly at the highest court level yet in Canada, but I'm sure it will be followed in Canada because it's the kind of thing our Canadian Supreme Court has shown a predilection towards following. Our court likes novel remedies. It likes departing from the old traditional common law views, and this is exactly the kind of thing it will, I'm sure, do. So, final thing. So if I was to sum up everything I've said, what I would say is that the law on remedies is good for lawyers. It's why they make a lot of money in the common law. If you're thinking of suing someone for a breach of contract, it's good to have a good lawyer. You need a good lawyer. The law gives you a huge range of options, and as importantly, there is a huge amount of very detailed law on remedies in the common law. So you want a good lawyer to look after you. Thank you very much.
I told you you were in for a treat. And by the way, when he criticized Article 1457 as wrong in the English version, when it uses the word liable to reparation, I hear something like that every day.
Oh, yes?
This article is wrong. It must be, you have to redraft the civil code.
Oh, sorry, wrong from, you hear it from me.
Yeah, I hear it from you. We do have a bit of time before we take a break. And I'm sure that this fascinating presentation has elicited some questions or comments from the audience. Or has he stunned you into silence? Go ahead, please. Okay, super.
Oh, go ahead.
I'm just going to repeat the question for the people in the breakout rooms. And the question has to do with what is the effect of juries on the quantification or the awarding of the role of juries in the awarding of damages.
Do you want to answer the question too? You can answer better than me.
I think it makes the amount of damages go up.
That's an easy one. But I thought you were asking, you know, when can you use juries and when can't you? Is that? And
I don't know when you can.
Right. And so this is
the role of the jury.
Well, in Canada, they have very little role in private law. There are a few areas where, this is where I'm not, this is, gets too useful and practical, so I don't know the answer, but there are a few areas where you can still use juries. Defamation is the main one. There is one or two others, I think, but defamation is the main private law area where you could still use juries. I mean, formerly you could use juries in all these cases, but after about the 1930s, they cut it down to only defamation, and so they just don't have much role. Now, in the U.S., you can have juries for private law actions, and as a consequence, well, you know, they have a big role in damages, and that's part of the reason that you get these massive punitive damage awards, although they often get chopped down by Court of Appeal decisions. We read about them, but they do get chopped down. Same thing. It's the rule about you can only use them for defamation cases. In private law cases, that's the UK rule also. I'll stop there.
Okay, go ahead.
Yes.
We're talking about a delay of 9 days.
Yes.
Saying certainly the transporter would not be responsible. What if the delay was not 9 days, but 6 months, or 8 months, or a year, and
Yeah.
I'm just going to repeat the question for our viewers across the hall. That's a great question. The question is going back to the sugar case, the Heron 2, where the ship was 9 days late and the price of sugar had fallen. The question is, would it have made a difference if the ship were 6 months late or 9 months late instead of 9 days?
Well, I think the answer is, in principle, they would be decided the same way. Now, it would make a difference in the limited sense that when I say that the 9 days you didn't get damages for the change in price. I mean, they did get some damages. I mean, there was some other expenses just arising from the delay. I don't know. You know, you'd have to sit around and wait. You maybe had to keep a warehouse open. So there would be some things that would be attributed to the delay. But the change in the market price, the court says, that's not a consequence of the delay, and it's not the sort of risk that we would think would be allocated. So if you stretch it to 6 months, the principle would be the same, so long as, you know, there's no way that one could predict in advance whether the prices are going to go up or down. If you know that prices are likely to be down in 6 months, then we can say, well, you know, it should be the responsibility of someone who's late because they know that, you know, lateness can have this effect. But otherwise, I mean, in principle, it would be the same. I can see the courts not being quite as sympathetic in practice, but, you know, in principle, it would be the same result.
I'm going to add a follow-up question. Would it matter if the shipper knew that the owner was going to be selling sugar in Basra on arrival?
Well, the question is, would it matter that if the owner knew that the the shipper knew that the owner was selling sugar? In the facts, the shipper did know that the owner was going to sell sugar. So that's why it's a good case. I mean, it's perfectly foreseeable that this loss can happen. I mean, it's a 50, you know, that if you are a day late or if you're a day early, there's a 50-50 chance the price will be different, a 50-50 chance it will be lower. So totally foreseeable. But the idea, I don't know what other people think about it. To me, it sounds right. This seems odd to put, you know, to make the shipper the insurer of the market price. It just seems odd, you know. If you want to force them to pay for the loss, they should also get the gain, too. Right? But not everyone agrees on this.
We'll
it's
take
controversial.
One more question before we break, and you want to follow up. Okay. Unless there's other fighting for a question. Maybe we'll take one more. Go ahead.
Yes.
Markets, slumps. I mean,
Yeah.
That's a straight damage thing that could be easily proved against the person who took the action.
You know, that's a really, that's a good question. And you make me realize that although I said the courts have done the same thing in tort, the tort cases where they've done them are actually cases where there is also contracts. Like the valuation case, they were suing them in tort, but they also did have contracts with the valuers. It was an example of commule, where they could sue in either contract or tort. And they went for contract because of limitation periods or something like that. But you're right that the courts are much more willing to say that these market prices, you're not responsible for that in a situation where there's a contract. Whereas in a, just a sort of standard case where somebody commits a tort damaging your property or something, and you're delayed, and then the market price goes down, the courts have not taken the same approach yet. And maybe they shouldn't. They've made you responsible for those market losses. So that market loss, that's a good point. It's not always that these market changes are irrelevant. But in cases where the parties have a contractual relationship and where they can then sort of protect themselves against these risks, think about the possibility of them, they've adopted this approach. But that's a very good point.
It's not just market prices.
Yeah.
Purchasers back out.
Sure, yeah.
You lose the sale.
Yeah.
Never mind that it goes.
Sure.
Great. Well, Steve, you've given us a wonderful presentation, and you've given us a lot to think about. And we all thank you very, very much. And we certainly deserve it. We'll take a short break, and then we'll be back with the equally easy law of restitution. I just realized this is a shark.
most common punitive damages in contract are, they're almost all cases of insurance. There's tons of them in the States. And there are all cases where people refuse to pay out in bad faith, right? And they, this is considered a particularly bad type of breach because if you get away with it, you know, you don't just breach, but the other person doesn't get anything, you know? So it's a really strong case for punitive damages. Even people who don't like punitive damages usually agree, these insurance companies, they should get it. But I don't know in Quebec. And I'm going to ask my colleague whether they think life insurance would be a consumer contract. That seems to be the question. All right?
Yes. Thank you very much. Very enjoyable. Okay.
All right. You're welcome.
Probably
Okay. Sorry about this. It's horrible. Terrible. Sort of dashing out, escaping their questions.
Welcome back. I'll ask you to take your seat. Start a little bit early. Oh, thank you for turning that on. Very helpful. So we'd like to start. Maître Rabinovich would like us to start. He'll have to leave a few minutes early tonight. So it's my pleasure to introduce to you our second speaker this evening. Thank you. Maître Rabinovich is a graduate of our faculty, so it's always a pleasure to welcome back our graduates in this to these events. In 2002, Ryan Rabinovich received a BCL and an LLB from McGill, where he received the Aimé Geoffrion Gold Medal. After graduation, he worked as a comparative law clerk for President Aaron Barak of the Supreme Court of Israel, and completed his master's degree in law at the University of Oxford. Mr. Rabinovich then served as a law clerk to the Honorable Justice Louise Arbour of the Supreme Court of Canada. He was called to the Bar of Quebec in 2006 and has worked as a tax attorney since that time. He currently works at McCarthy Tétrault in Montreal, where he practices in all aspects of tax planning and litigation. And since 2009, we have the good fortune of having Maître Rabinovich teach as a sessional lecturer in the faculty, specifically teaching restitution. So please join me in welcoming Maître Ryan Rabinovich.
Okay. Apologies for the little bit of a rushed version of this presentation you're going to get, but hopefully it will be an interesting one. So I'll be talking about two things in this presentation. The first will be restitution generally, which is the title of the presentation, but admittedly the bulk of the presentation will really be about the law of unjust enrichment, which is intimately tied to but not necessarily synonymous, at least depending on who you ask, with restitution. So turning to the first topic of what is restitution? As Professor Smith alluded to in his talk, it's something of an ambiguous term. I think if you asked the man on the street, or you know, you asked your mother, what does restitution mean? I suspect they tell you that they say it means to give something back. So A may give B $100, and if he seeks restitution of the $100 from B, he wants B to give it back. But sometimes the law, and particularly the common law, uses restitution in a different sense, which is the disgorgement sense that Professor Smith was referring to. And then it's really a giving up. We're not asking the defendant to give something back that the plaintiff gave to the defendant, but rather to give up something that he may or may not have received from the plaintiff. So, for example, a person can make, let's take an example, a person who makes $100 by selling copies of a book in which another person has a copyright without the copyright holder's permission. So the copyright holder may sue the copyright breacher and seek restitution of the $100, but if he's successful, the copyright holder is not giving back the $100. He didn't get the $100 from the copyright holder. He got it from his customers. He's giving up the $100. Now, you may ask, is this just semantics? Does it really matter whether it means giving up or giving back? It's not just semantics, because a plaintiff will usually rather have restitution in the giving up sense than the giving back sense, because he doesn't want recovery to be limited to what came from his own pocket. He wants all of the defendant's profits. The second important thing to remember when we talk about restitution, and it's appropriate in the context of this lecture, to emphasize that restitution is sometimes referred to as though it was a cause of action. So sometimes you'll hear people talk about torts, contracts, and restitution, which is a bit of a funny list of things to put together, because restitution is really a remedy. It's not a cause of action. So restitution, and I think Professor Smith's lecture neatly captured that, is analogous really to compensation, right? So when someone seeks compensation, this begs the question, is compensation for what? Compensation for negligence, for a tort or a delict in civil law? Is it compensation for a breach of contract? And so similarly, when someone says, I want restitution, that begs the question, restitution for what? Is it restitution for what cause of action is it that's giving rise to your right to restitution? And typically, we think of restitution as being a remedy for unjust enrichment. Now, an interesting question is restitution only a remedy for unjust enrichment? Are there other causes of action that could give rise to this restitutionary remedy? And as Professor Smith pointed out in his lecture, if we mean restitution in the giving up sense, the answer seems to be yes. So taking the copyright holder example I gave before, if you look in the Copyright Act, you'll see that a person who breaches a copyright one of the things that they can do is sue the person who breached their copyright or their intellectual property rights for all the profits that they've received. They don't seek the court to compensate them for their loss. They may not have suffered any loss, but rather they seek the court to say to the defendant, you breached my copyright. You earned, $1 million in doing so. It didn't cost me anything, but I want that $1 million. So you can get restitution in that giving up sense in certain tort and tort-like cases, like breach of intellectual property. And as the very colorful case of Attorney General versus Blake demonstrates, it seems that at least in certain cases, you can get restitution for breach of contract, right? Remember in Attorney General versus Blake, this is the ex-spy that we saw a picture of. The Crown sues the spy to recover royalties that the spy gets from his publisher in connection with the publication of his autobiography. The Crown was not suing to get back royalties that it gave to the spy, obviously. It was suing the spy to get all the profits that the spy had earned. So it seems that we can have restitution as a remedy for causes of action other than unjust enrichment, but it seems that it's only in the giving up, only restitution if we mean it in that giving up sense, which leaves restitution in the giving back sense, right? I give you something and I sue to get it back. It looks like, and the common law is not, the scholars and the case law is not unanimous on this point, that restitution is only available in the giving back sense as a remedy for the cause of action of unjust enrichment. And so it's for that reason that I'm going to focus the rest of this presentation on unjust enrichment. So remember throughout the presentation that the plaintiff in an unjust enrichment case can't recover all the profits earned by the defendant. He only gets restitution of what came from his own pocket. He can only get back what he gave. If you didn't give it, you can't sue for it. So what is unjust enrichment? It's a topic that we don't often hear about. It's not often talked about in Quebec, and until recently, it wasn't often talked about, until relatively recently, I should say, it wasn't often talked about in the common law. So what are the three basic ingredients of unjust enrichment? Well, they're the same, actually, in the common law and the civil law, and as some of you may know, generally, the first element of the cause of action is that the defendant has to be enriched. The second element of the cause of action is that the plaintiff has to suffer a corresponding deprivation. And the third element of the cause of action is that the enrichment and corresponding deprivation are unjust for some reason. And if the plaintiff makes out these three elements, he gets restitution, right? So again, unjust enrichment is the cause of action, and restitution is the response to that cause of action. It's the remedy that the court grants you when you make out all the elements of the cause of action. The classic example of unjust enrichment in the common law is a mistaken payment. And I don't know if some of you are from McGill and you did or you did your common law, you'll know that Donahue and Stevenson is the tort case, the negligence case. Well, Kelly versus Solari is the Donahue versus Stevenson of unjust enrichment in a way. And it's really our classic archetypal case of unjust enrichment. So the facts are actually simple in Kelly versus Solari. We have a man named Mr. Solari who purchases an insurance policy, and the terms of the insurance policy provide that there's a payout to the beneficiary of his choosing as long as he makes all the premium payments, which is what you'd typically imagine that an insurance policy would say. Mr. Solari designates his wife, and then he dies. Unfortunately, just before his death, he misses a payment, which causes the insurance policy under its terms to lapse. So technically speaking, the insurance company is not required to pay Mrs. Solari this £1,000 payout, but for reasons unknown, there's confusion in the insurance company, and they make the payment. Somebody realizes the mistake, and the insurance company sues Mrs. Solari for the £1,000. They say, oh, we paid this to you, but the insurance policy had lapsed. You actually should never have got it. And the court grants restitution, and Mrs. Solari is forced to give up the £1,000. So before we turn, before we take a closer look at unjust enrichment and particularly the three elements of the cause of action, I'd like to highlight what's perhaps the most striking feature of unjust enrichment, again, in both legal systems, which is both common law and civil law legal systems, and that's that it's strict liability. That's really one of the most striking features. We don't really like strict liability, and so, you know, generally speaking, though not always, but generally speaking, in delict, you have to demonstrate a fault on the part of the defendant, or if you want to sue in breach of contract, you have to show the defendant did at least something wrong in the sense that they breached the contract. In unjust enrichment, you don't have to show the defendant did anything wrong. And there's two ways, that's one way that fault is irrelevant, and that's one way in which unjust enrichment is strict liability, namely that you don't have to prove that the defendant did anything wrong. But the other way, and this is makes unjust enrichment all the more striking, is that the plaintiff plaintiff's claim can't be defeated even if it's his own fault that there's been an enrichment and corresponding deprivation. So you're in a paradoxical and really funny private law situation where a non-innocent plaintiff can recover from an innocent defendant, which is definitely not something we're used to. So to take the example of Kelly versus Solari, right, you have Mrs. Solari who just received £1,000, right? She received a payment by mistake. She's done nothing wrong. She seems to be innocent. And you have the insurance company, which seems to have been a little negligent, right? People in the insurance company, you know, somebody made a mistake. Somebody wasn't paying attention to the insurance policy, and they made the payment by accident. And yet the court says it doesn't matter. Mrs. Solari has to give the money back. So how can we explain this? This is, like, abhorrent to private law and to everything we know about the private law. And the answer seems to be that making restitution is just so easy in an unjust enrichment case. We're not asking the defendant to pay an amount that will leave him worse off. We're just saying, just give back what you never should have received, right? We say to the defendant, we just want to put you back in the position you would have been in if, in an ideal world, none of this had happened. So the defendant doesn't have to reach into his own pocket to make restitution and to give back to the plaintiff what the plaintiff gave him unjustly. He just has to give back what he received. We're not making him worse off. And because it's so easy, the answer is that we don't really care if it's the plaintiff's fault. And we don't really care if you didn't do anything wrong. All we're asking to do is just give it back. To give us a point of reference, perhaps like the most sensible thing to do is to talk about what unjust enrichment is in civil law and then compare it to how it looks in the common law. Because the systems are similar, though not identical. So unjust enrichment is actually scattered around the civil code in three large groups of places. The first is specific rules in the civil code that are arguably instantiations of unjust enrichment. Why do I say instantiations of unjust enrichment? They're all cases where a defendant is ordered to make restitution in a situation where there's been an enrichment of the defendant, a corresponding deprivation of the plaintiff, and an injustice, right? The three elements of the cause of action. So let's take three things that we all learn about in law school in Quebec. Articles 955 and following of the Quebec Civil Code. Okay, these are getting a little less popular in the 21st century, but it's the landowner's obligations to pay for improvements made to the land by a possessor in good faith, right? So let's say, for example, I possess your land. I think that it's my land. I think that I'm the true owner, and I build a building on the land, or I till the soil, or I do something that improves the value of the land, and it turns out, unbeknownst to me, I'm not the true owner. There's a defect in my title, and you're the true owner, and you come along and you take back the land. You can actually sue me. I can actually sue you for the value of the improvements that I gave to the land, because I've enriched you. Those improvements have increased the value of what turned out to be your land, and it's come at my expense. I might have expended considerable sums of money to make the improvements, certainly time. And it just doesn't seem fair for you to walk away with the product of my labor. So the law requires you to give me restitution, to pay me, essentially, for the value of my services. The next example, and this one's a little bit controversial, but is Article 1483 of the and following of the Civil Code, the provisions on gestion d'affaires, which is the management of the business of another, or negotiarum gestio in Roman law. And these are the provisions that deal, again, a little less common in nowadays, but we have analogies with the modern world. But let's say I'm a farmer, and I notice that your cow is wandering out of the stable, or whatever it is that they keep cows, and I say, and you're nowhere to be found, and so because I'm a good Samaritan and I'm a good neighbor, I take your cow and I bring him to my stable and I feed your cow and I house your cow. The article, the provisions in the Civil Code on gestion d'affaires say I can recover the value of the money that I spend on taking care of what is in effect your business for you. And again, you can ask yourself, isn't that just unjust enrichment, right? I'm clearly enriching you by providing you with, by doing this for you. And it's there's a corresponding impoverishment on my part. I have to lay out money for food and shelter. And it just seems unfair that you should have the product of my labor and you effectively get restitution. The last example, and there are others in the code, is one that Professor Smith mentioned in his talk, which is Article 1606 of the Quebec Civil Code, which says that where a contract is resolved, it's deemed never to have existed. It's anéanti rétroactivement, I think. And in that case, each party is bound to restore to the other the prestations he has received under the contract, right? So if I choose to resolve a contract, and I happen to have made payments under the contract to you, and you happen to have given things to me, we've both enriched each other, we've both suffered a corresponding deprivation, and given the invalidity of the contract, just doesn't seem fair that the other person should keep what the counterparty provided. So hard to argue that this isn't all unjust enrichment, even though we never call it that, and we didn't learn it that way in law school. The second, and perhaps less controversially unjust enrichment provision in the Civil Code, although not called unjust enrichment, is the provision on the provisions on réception de l'indu, receipt of a thing not due. And that's Articles 1491 and following the Civil Code. And you'll find here that this is actually the Kelly versus Solari provision of the Quebec Civil Code, right? And I said Kelly versus Solari is the paradigmatic example of unjust enrichment. So it's funny that in the civil law, we don't even call the Kelly versus Solari rule unjust enrichment, but unjust enrichment it is all the same. The provision says that a person who receives a payment made in error is obliged to restore it, right? Again, if I receive a payment in error, I've been enriched. The person who paid it has been impoverished. And it seems unjust for me to keep the payment. And the law grants restitution. And the last example, and the reason why it's last, is because the civil law is explicit to the effect that it's just the residual category. It's the principle of unjustified enrichment, which catches all instances of unjust enrichment that are not specifically provided for in the code, like the ones we've just talked about, is Article 1493 and following of the Quebec Civil Code, which says that a person who is enriched at the expense of another shall, to the extent of his enrichment, indemnify the other for his correlative impoverishment if there is no justification for the enrichment or impoverishment. So that's basically unjust enrichment in the civil law in a nutshell. So what does unjust enrichment look like in the common law? And I guess unsurprisingly, the answer is it's something similar in the sense that the same way unjust enrichment is scattered across the civil law, it's also scattered across the common law. So I won't bother going through these funny Latin terms and whatnot that I have listed here. But basically, the law of unjust enrichment, as we know it, is just scattered in what we refer to, common lawyers refer to as pigeonholes throughout the law. There's a bunch of cases in the law of trust that seem to really be embodiments of this idea that one person is enriched at the other person's expense, and it's unjust for the enriched person to keep the enrichment. Some parts are in the law of quantum merit and quantum valebit. Some parts are in the law of trusts. And it was not really recognized that these were all instantiations in a similar way that we don't really recognize explicitly today that in Quebec, all the provisions I listed are unjust enrichment. The same was true in the common law till about 1940, when two doctrinal scholars, Warren Seavey and Austin Scott, published a book, or rather the restatement of the law of restitution, quasi-contracts, and constructive trusts. And they said, really, for the first time in the common law world, all this stuff that's all around the common law, it's all one thing. These are all cases where we have an enrichment, a corresponding deprivation, and an injustice. And so we should stop referring to them as being part of the law of trusts and part of the law of maritime salvage. We should just say we have a law of unjust enrichment, or they called it restitution, but for our purposes, unjust enrichment. So what happens after that, unfortunately, is the subject actually dies in the U.S. after that, in the common law world. And it's really in the U.K. that the torch is taken up by two professors, or actually one of them is not a professor, but Robert Goff and Gareth Jones, who published a book called The Law of Restitution in 1966, and by Peter Birks, who is arguably, you know, the great father of the law of restitution or unjust enrichment in the common law world, who wrote a book called An Introduction to the Law of Restitution in 1985. And when these books are published, there's suddenly a flurry of activity in the common law world on this new idea that all this stuff scattered all over the place is really one thing, and it's unjust enrichment. And it actually covers quite a large, some would say a third, really, of the private law world. We have contract law, tort law, and some would say unjust enrichment law. And it took a long time for the courts to admit this, even though, of course, we had unjust enrichment in the common law. It's not until, actually, 1980, Canada, which I believe is the first Supreme Court, Canada's Supreme Court, is the first common law Supreme Court to explicitly recognize this, that all of this stuff hiding in all these places in the common law, just like the stuff hiding in all the provisions of the civil code we looked at, is one thing. It's unjust enrichment. And a similar case, a similar thing happens in the UK in 1991 in a case called Lipkin-Gorman. So according to these doctrinal scholars and these cases, right, that finally admitted that we had this thing called unjust enrichment, as we say, there were three elements to the cause of action: enrichment, corresponding deprivation, and an injustice. And what was notable about the common law, or which will become, you know, we'll talk about it in sort of great depth, is the third aspect of the third element of the cause of action, the injustice. The common law had a particular approach to how to determine whether there was an injustice. It wasn't just that the judge felt that it wasn't fair that the defendant should keep the enrichment. There was more to it than that. What the common law said was you have to show that there was a presence of one of a list of categories of unjust factors, basically. You have to show that your case fell within one of, you know, a dozen or so specific types of case where an enrichment and corresponding deprivation was unjust. So in Kelly versus Solari, for example, the unjust factor would have been mistake. And mistake is, as I say, the archetypal case of unjust enrichment and the archetypal unjust factor. It's the main one that everybody learns in an unjust enrichment or restitution course. And the unjust factors, and we'll look at some of them in depth, were basically grouped into three categories. There were three types of things you could show to show that an enrichment and a corresponding deprivation were unjust. There were plaintiff-sided unjust factors, defendant-sided unjust factors, and policy-based unjust factors. So what are the plaintiff-sided unjust factors? Essentially, they all amount to situations where the plaintiff is effectively saying, I didn't really mean you to have what I gave you. I mean, I might have thought I meant it, but I was mistaken. So there's some vitiation of my consent or my voluntariness, right? So mistake is a great example. Or it could be duress, right? Again, like someone put a gun to my head and forced me to give you $100. I didn't really want you to have the $100. I should really be able to get it back. You've been enriched by the $100. I've been impoverished by the $100. there's no real intentionality here, no genuine consent here. It's unjust. I should get it back. So these two cases, mistake and duress that I'm talking about, which are probably the easiest cases in unjust enrichment and plaintiff-sided, of the plaintiff-sided unjust factors, are the types of situation covered by réception de l'injure in Article 1391 of 1491, sorry, I think, of the Quebec Civil Code. But unjust enrichment in the common law recognize other types of involuntariness which would give rise to this injustice as well. And a kind of colorful case is Louth versus Diprose. It's a case decided by the High Court of Australia on undue influence, which was a type of involuntariness that counted as injustice. So Mr. Diprose falls desperately in love with Ms. Louth, who convinces him that it would be a good idea if he bought her a house. And unfortunately, once Mr. Diprose comes to his senses and discovers that Miss Louth is never going to fall for him, he sues her successfully in unjust enrichment on the basis that she unduly influenced him to give him the house. So again, I meant you to have it, but I was under the influence, if you will. So I didn't really mean you to have it, and I want it back, and he got it back. He got the house. The next... next type of unjust factor was the second family of unjust factors were these defendant-sided unjust factors, or I should say defendant-sided unjust factor, because there only seemed to be one, which was free acceptance. There was a lot of talk about free acceptance and what it meant for a defendant to freely accept an enrichment, but Canada is actually the only jurisdiction that ever came out and said that this was an unjust factor explicitly in a case called Petkus versus Becker, which is a case that a lot of us learn about in family law, but it's a plaintiff and a defendant who are a common law couple, and the plaintiff basically supports the defendant and does basically free labor on the defendant's farm for all the years that they're a common law couple, and then they break up, and she says, wait a minute, this wasn't a gift. She says, you've been enriched, it's at my expense, and this is unjust. I want unjust enrichment. I want to sue you for the value of what I gave you. And in fact, she sues him for half, I think it was, the value of all of his property. And the court says that the defendant in this case has to make restitution because he freely accepted the benefits conferred by the plaintiff. And the court actually says, what does that mean, freely accepted? The defendant sat back and allowed the plaintiff to confer the benefit, knowing that she didn't intend it to constitute a gift. She gave the benefit on the basis that the couple would stay together and that she'd enjoy the fruits of her labor. She didn't intend to just give her common law husband something and then be cut loose at some point. So now I'm cognizant of the fact that I said before that unjust enrichment was strict liability, and it didn't matter that the defendant did anything wrong. And I don't think what the court is saying here is that the defendant in Petkus versus Becker did something wrong. I think what the court is saying is that having chosen to accept the benefit from the plaintiff, knowing that the plaintiff didn't intend it as a gift, that just gives rise to the obligation to make restitution. That is what's unjust about the situation is that the plaintiff did not intend to make a gift, and the defendant knew that the plaintiff did not intend to make a gift, and that just simply gives rise to the obligation to make restitution. There's nothing wrong with receiving a gift and knowing that somebody intends to be paid for it. What's wrong is just not paying for it. So the last family of unjust factors are the policy-based unjust factors, and there are several, but I'll only talk about one. And one is the policy of encouraging rescue. And this has been something of a controversial topic in the law of unjust enrichment, but it's clear that in certain circumstances, the common law will deem an enrichment and corresponding deprivation to be unjust, and thus grant restitution to the plaintiff as a way of encouraging plaintiffs to come to the rescue of their neighbors. So in the famous case, and there's a lot of famous Canadian cases in unjust enrichment, for real. I'm not just saying that because I'm Canadian and you are as well. Matheson versus Smiley is a decision in 1932 by the Manitoba Court of Appeal. Defendant shoots himself in the head in an attempted suicide attempt and is taken to hospital where the plaintiff, a doctor, treats him, unfortunately, unsuccessfully. The patient dies. And the plaintiff then, the doctor, sues the defendant's estate for the value of his services. And he says, again, I gave up my valuable time to do this. I was impoverished. You were enriched. Now let's put aside the question for a moment of whether a person who wants to commit suicide is enriched by the provision of the services. But this is 1932, and the Manitoba Court of Appeal is not amused by that argument. And the Manitoba Court of Appeal says we're going to grant restitution effectively here as a way of so that everybody knows that if they come to the rescue of their neighbors in this kind of situation, they're going to get remunerated, right? So we want to encourage people to come to the rescue of their neighbors. The only way to do that is to grant them restitution in this type of circumstance. And this is the civil law equivalent of my cow example, right? The gestion d'affaires, management of the business of another. In Article 1482 of the Quebec Civil Code, I house the cow. I come to the rescue, basically, of my neighbor by managing his cow and his business, and it's only fair that the neighbor should have to pay me. And we do this because we want society to work in this fashion. We want people to help each other. So what happens? This, as I say, is the traditional model of unjust enrichment. And for basically hundreds of years, this is the approach courts were taking to the law of unjust enrichment. Even though they weren't saying it was called unjust enrichment, they were basically requiring these three elements, an enrichment, an impoverishment, and an unjust factor. They got these families of unjust factors that developed. In the 1980s, the Supreme Court of Canada begins to change the approach to the third factor. And the court no longer required the plaintiff to show the presence of an unjust factor, to show that the enrichment and deprivation were unjust, but rather that the plaintiff must demonstrate the absence of a juristic reason for the enrichment. So it's not the presence of something, not the presence of something bad that makes the enrichment and corresponding deprivation unjust, but the absence of something good that makes the enrichment and corresponding deprivation unjust. So what the court was asked is a juristic reason. What are the good things that I have to show to make sure that this is just? And the answer given by the court was basically you have to show that the plaintiff was obligated either by a contract or a statute to confer what he conferred, or that even though he wasn't obligated, he had the intention basically of making a gift. He had a donative intention, a genuine intention to confer an enrichment on the defendant. So what's interesting for us as Quebecers and as civilians is that the absence of juristic reason test, you'll notice, and the list of juristic reasons that I just mentioned bears a very strong similarity to what you'd find if you looked at Article 1493 and 1494 of the Quebec Civil Code, right? So 1493 says that an enrichment and a corresponding deprivation give rise to the obligation to make restitution if there is no justification, just like no juristic reason, right? And what is a justification? According to Article 1494 of the Code, the performance of an obligation results in an enrichment being justified. And or, for example, if I confer the enrichment with a constant liberal intention, right? So these are just like the juristic reasons that I just mentioned, right? A statutory or contractual obligation to confer the gift, to confer the enrichment, or a donative intention to confer a gift. So really the common law in Canada has switched over and almost explicitly, it doesn't actually say this, but it's hard to believe that the court is not literally borrowing from the civil code or the civil law in this respect. And in fact, the case where this happens is decided only a couple of years and by the same court that first recognized the law of unjustified enrichment in Quebec in the case called Compagnie Vigée versus Giguère. It's the 1977 Supreme Court that recognizes what the founding case in Quebec civil law of unjustified enrichment. It's the same bench that hands down the case where they make this switch. So it really does seem that the court is literally borrowing from Quebec civil law, which you rarely see, as you know, in Canada. It's usually the Quebec civil law, or tends to be the Quebec civil law, that borrows from the common law. But in this case, it really was the other way around. Confusion ensued. The common law is, as you all know, at least from public law and by reputation, it's precedent-based, it's traditional. They've been doing the same thing for hundreds and hundreds of years. And so courts just were not comfortable with this switch. They said, what are we supposed to do? Ignore 400 years of cases because the Supreme Court has said that we're now going to follow this approach, which comes, I think, from the civil code. And I don't even know what a civil code is. And really, you do have pandemonium. So in 2004, there's a Supreme Court case called Garland versus Consumers Gas, literally on this point. And the court is asked, please clarify, have we really switched over to the civil law? Have we really abandoned 400 years of jurisprudence? And the court says, yes, we have abandoned 400 years of jurisprudence. It's a new game. We are doing the civil law thing, the Quebec civil law thing. But unfortunately, in the 8 years since that time, courts continue to flip-flop between the two approaches. Some courts say, oh, what, Garland versus consumer gas? Other courts say, yeah, but it's the common law. You know, for 400 years, we've been doing it this way, and including, unfortunately, the Supreme Court. Sometimes you have cases where they refer to mistake and the other unjust factors. In some cases, they refer to the juristic reasons. And so we really don't know where we are today in the common law. What's also interesting is that a very similar debate and a very similar sort of flip-flop, I guess, is going on in the UK. And it's interesting that it's going on in the UK for us as Quebecers, because it's very clear in the UK cases where that basically what happens in some House of Lords, or I guess now the UK Supreme Court cases, you get half the court that says, we really think the UK should do, just like Canada, should move to the civil law model, the absence of justification, absence of cause, absence of juristic reason approach, just like the Canadian Supreme Court did, and half the court saying, no, 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 this is the common law, and we use the presence, we require the presence of an unjust factor. And what's interesting is, you see, it's the Scottish law lords who advocate that the common law should move towards the absence of juristic reason approach, and the English law lords who tend to say, no, no, we should keep using the unjust factor model. And so you have a mixed jurisdiction, in effect, right, the United Kingdom, where the civil law judges are influencing the common law judges, and that's exactly, it seems, what has happened here. So in the mother of all common law jurisdictions, the same thing is going on. Next interesting point about the law of unjust enrichment is what is an enrichment? And it may sound straightforward, right, that has the defendant been enriched, but not entirely so. The common law is very liberal, or at least for a time was very liberal, and was very focused on freedom of contract and freedom generally, and didn't like the idea of forcing people to pay for goods or services that they didn't want and didn't purchase. And taking an example of the basic example of unjust enrichment, I give you a gift thinking it's your birthday, and in fact your birthday was 6 months ago. And so I've made a mistake, right? And I sue you in unjust enrichment for the value of the gift. If I win, right, and the court says I order the defendant to pay the value of the gift to the plaintiff, what ends up happening is the defendant is left with the gift and has given the plaintiff the fair market value of the gift, and effectively the court has forced the defendant to buy the gift. And the courts don't like that, and they didn't like the idea of forcing people to buy things they didn't want. And so the general rule that they came up with was that a defendant can get out of liability in an unjust enrichment case by saying that he did not want and did not value the thing that he got from the plaintiff. So enrichment is, as a default rule, and we'll talk about some exceptions to that, a subjective principle in the common law. So it's open to defendants say, well, maybe you would regard that as an enrichment, but not me. And this is called in the jargon, in the common law restitution jargon, subjective devaluation. The defendant is allowed to devalue the thing on subjective grounds. But it's subject to several exceptions, right? Because remember, the idea here is that we don't want to force people to buy things they didn't want. And in some cases, it's just not plausible to say that you don't value the thing that you received. So what are some examples? Right? Money is an example. Everybody values money. And you'll say, no, there are some people who don't value money. But even those people can take the money and buy something that they do value with it. Right? So the theory goes that no one could possibly say that money is not enriching. And the second example, there are others as well, but the second example is if the plaintiff can show the defendant requested the benefit, how can the defendant say, I didn't want it? Right? You asked for it. So of course you wanted it. So the rule that the defendant can say, I didn't want it and don't value it, is subject to the exception of if it doesn't make sense to say that, it doesn't apply. Corresponding deprivation. What is a corresponding deprivation? Now, I think the most obvious reading of what a corresponding deprivation is what seems to just come out of the word, which is that there has to be some equivalence in value between the enrichment and the impoverishment. And what we generally mean by that, I think, is that the plaintiff can only recover the amount of his impoverishment to the extent that it's matched by an equivalent enrichment in the hands of the defendant. So plaintiff can't recover the amount of his impoverishment up to the amount that the defendant has been enriched. The next sort of interpretation of what a corresponding deprivation is that there the courts have suggested that there has to be a direct link between the plaintiff and the defendant. The enrichment has to come directly from the plaintiff. So it has to literally be a giving of something from me to you. I'm impoverished, and correspondingly, you're enriched, one to the other. And a good example of that is the case of the Queen versus M. Geller, Inc., which is a 1963 Supreme Court case. The plaintiff in the case agrees to pay a third party to dress sheepskins for it. I'm not sure what dressing sheepskins are, but I think that means to work it in some way, like that leather gets worked, I guess. And there was a special dressing tax, believe it or not, in 1963 in Canada, and dressers were liable for a tax on the number of skins that they dressed. So in this case, the plaintiff asks the third party to dress the sheepskins, and the third party says, yeah, but if I dress this for you, I'm going to be liable for this tax, so I'm only agreeing to dress it if you pay me an amount of money that's enough for me to pay the tax. I don't want to bear the tax. You're going to bear the tax. So they agree, and the plaintiff pays the amount to the defendant, to the third party, the dresser, and the dresser pays the amount to the government. Now, it turns out that this dressing tax applies to all kinds of skins, but not sheepskins, and the parties actually made a mistake. And the tax actually wasn't exigible in this case, and so the plaintiff says to the government, he doesn't sue the third party, he chooses to sue the government, he says, that money that you got from the dresser came from me. I paid him the money that then he paid you, and I want it back. I paid it by mistake. If I had read the law properly, you never would have got that amount, right? This is like Kelly versus Solari, right? You received an amount of money due to my error, and I want it back. And the answer, according to the Supreme Court, is you can't leapfrog, right? So the government may have been enriched, and the plaintiff may have been impoverished, but the enrichment didn't come directly from the plaintiff, and so it doesn't correspond. They don't correspond. The last thing that we're going to talk about is the special defense that unjust enrichment has, which is the defense of change of position. A defendant in an unjust enrichment case can be relieved from liability to the extent that he can show that he no longer has the enrichment conferred by the plaintiff. We say that he's changed his position. Yes, I received $1,000 from you. Yes, I know you paid it to me in error, but I don't have it anymore. I gave it away to somebody else. And the same is true in Quebec civil law. So if you look at Article 1495 of the Civil Code, we have the exact same rule, and all the civil law jurisdictions have this rule as well. So there's a universal agreement that you should be able to get out of liability to saying you no longer have the enrichment. Why? Now, the logic of change of position is tied to the reasoning underlying the strict liability nature of unjust enrichment. I said before that unjust enrichment is strict liability, and this is fair. Because making restitution is so easy. We're not making the defendant worse off, right? We're just saying, just give him back what you never should have received. You'll be in exactly the same position you were in before the transaction happened, and everyone walks away happy. But to the extent that the defendant changes his position and no longer has the enrichment, he does have to dig into his own pocket, right, to pay the plaintiff. So in Kelly versus Solari, if Mrs. Solari had gone out and made a donation to charity with the £1,000 she got from the insurance company, right? If the court would have ordered her to make restitution, she would have had to go into her own bank account, take out £1,000, and she'd, at the end of the day, be £1,000 worse off. And courts don't like that. So they say strict liability is justified to the extent that it doesn't leave the defendant worse off. So when it does leave the defendant worse off because he's changed his position or no longer has the enrichment, it's not fair to impose liability. So in summary, so we have restitution and we have unjust enrichment. Not necessarily the same thing. And restitution is somewhat an ambiguous term. It sometimes means givings up, sometimes givings back. Restitution is a remedy and not a cause of action. And it seems that when it's a remedy for unjust enrichment, it's limited to its giving back sense. The plaintiff can only recover what came from his own pocket. Unjust enrichment, strict liability, very bizarre in the private law, both in the common law and the civil law. And has three elements to the cause of action: enrichment, again, subjective; corresponding deprivation, which has this corresponding notion, has two aspects; and the third element of the cause of action being that the enrichment and corresponding deprivation are unjust. There's a state of civil war in the common law as to what it takes to make this enrichment and corresponding deprivation unjust. Is it an unjust presence of an unjust factor or absence of a juristic reason? And then that unjust enrichment has its special defense, which is change of position. Thank you.
Yeah, I think there's a question.
Thank you very much. Maître Rabinovich will have to leave a few minutes early, but he does have a few minutes to take some questions from the audience. So please, if there are any questions. Sir, yes.
This is a very interesting question, and in fact is a very live issue in England in the common law, because they actually formulate the three elements of the cause of action slightly differently than we do in Canada. But in Canada, because of the way we formulate the second element of the cause of action, there must be a corresponding impoverishment, right? It's implicit in our three requirements that you can only sue the defendant up to the value of your impoverishment. So if I gave you stocks worth, I guess then you could say it begs the question, when does the impoverishment get measured? But in theory, you know, if I give you stocks worth $100 and then, you know, they happen to go up to $1,000, you'd say, well, what I gave you was I've lost 100 and you've gained 1,000. I can only sue you for 100. But we don't really have an answer for this. We don't have an answer in England, and we don't really have an answer in Canada.
Yes, sir.
So it's a very interesting. That's a very interesting comment in light of Professor Smith's speech, right? Again, we said for a civilian, this is a typical civilian reaction, right? But remember, in the common law says that you can provide in your contract that it's terminated for any reason whatsoever. It could be a small, trifling little thing. You could say, well, that's a good enough reason. The insurance company is able to terminate the contract if it wants on that basis, and that's been the position of the common law. In the civil law, right, we said that notwithstanding any stipulation to the contrary, right, in the civil law, you can't just, even if you say in the contract that the insurance company could terminate the contract in this case, that might not be the case, right? So again, this is just a feature of the common law.
There was a third question from a gentleman, yes.
The question, I think, would be more would depend ultimately on whether the parties actually got married or not. For the only reason that, and this is true in Quebec as well, and in the common law as well, but we do have the system of parliamentary sovereignty, and when Parliament sort of steps in and occupies the field and says this is the regime, the private law will generally shy away and say I'm not interfering with that. And in Canada, because of the Divorce Act, right, and because of the matrimonial property regimes in the provinces, there's a statutory answer to this, and the law of unjust enrichment would shy away basically from answering that question. You'd have to rely on whatever you could get under divorce and matrimonial property legislation.
You could ask a revocation of the donation for ingratitude.
Right.
All right, well, allow me on your behalf to thank Maître Rabinovich and to say as well that for those of you who are interested, there are a number of copies of Maître Rabinovich's presentation available for you. And I'd like to thank all of you for your presence over this year, to wish you a very good summer, and hope to see you next year. Thank you very much.